Hi, I'm Adrian Hill, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 7th, 2013. We asked you to write in and tell us what's on your minds. And in all the places you reached us, on our website and on Facebook and on Twitter, the same thing comes up over and over and over, week after week, and that's retirement.
I put away some money, like everyone does, with some sort of retirement plan. I got started a little bit late on that. Otherwise, I need to devote more to it. I think that's one of the big problems people don't do is they don't save enough, and I'm as guilty as the next man on that one.
I guess I'm kind of nervous because I know that people are living longer, and so I want to make sure that when the time comes, I do have enough money saved away.
I have a 401k, and also I have two IRAs. One is from my job, and other one I pay myself. I'm feeling, you know, not really secure because the situation, the economical situation, is changing very drastically for the new people. I don't feel nice. I don't feel well. I don't feel sure.
I don't feel too good about my retirement because I don't have enough saved now, and I don't like the way the government takes our money and does whatever they want to do, and we don't have that option to invest it in certain funds. You know, we have a lot of people in our government who don't know how to manage money, especially ours.
Retirement. How to plan it, how to save for it, where to invest it. So we're going to spend most of the rest of the hour talking about your plans for your future and your money. But we wanted to start in Jefferson County, Alabama, where this week they reached a deal to get out of bankruptcy. Kyle Whitmeyer is a reporter with the Birmingham News and a resident of Jefferson County. And he joins us now to talk about what happens when a community spends more than it can afford. Hey, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
So what happened there in Jefferson County?
Well, in the late 90s, Jefferson County was sued because its sewer system had grown into just tremendous disrepair. It had to repair its sewer system, and it borrowed a lot of money to do that. And so what they thought was going to be a $500 million project or $1 billion project turned out to be more than $3 billion of debt that the county accumulated. And no one really knew how to pay this off until, you know, Wall Street came to town with some very sophisticated debt structures, which they sold to Jefferson County. And all those fell apart during the financial crisis, leaving the county suddenly with accelerated interest payments, accelerated principal payments.
So this is like those homeowners who got in trouble during the crisis when they had sort of arms on their mortgages. It sort of blew up. Is that right?
I sometimes call this the world's biggest adjustable rate mortgage. This was something that, in much the same way that a homeowner thinks, oh, the bank wouldn't be lending me this money if they didn't think I could pay this back.
If I couldn't afford it.
You know, in some ways, it was really more like a credit card that you never pay off. You just make the interest payments, or like with a mortgage, when the rates start going up and the payments start going up, we'll just refinance again. Well, when that day came, they couldn't refinance because of what happened to the market. And throughout all of this, you also had county commissioners going to jail because of bribery schemes with sewer contractors, and in a couple cases with bribery schemes with bankers who were involved in this. It's been very embarrassing for the county, and I think the county is very eager to get out of this.
What's the deal mean for folks who live there, the deal to get out of bankruptcy?
Well, the most immediate thing is it means sewer rates are going to begin going up again. One thing that has happened in the last few years, sewer rates were frozen in place. That sounds great, but they had gone up 400% in the last 10 years. So this sort of put a halt to that. But now we're looking at sewer rates as part of this deal. Sewer rates are going to be going up again.
Now, you live in Jefferson County, is that right?
I do.
How's it feel to sort of be living in this community that overspent, that wound up in trouble like this?
It's embarrassing. I mean, if you go to the Jefferson County Courthouse and you look up on the wall just outside the commission chambers, you know, they have all the pictures of the former county commissioners. And, you know, half of those folks have gone to jail or in jail or have gone and come back. It's a rogues gallery. And, you know, there's a lot of anger at the public officials who got us into this mess. And we feel duped. They're, you know, bankers who came here who have been recorded on their own tapes, on their own trading floor, saying things like, who are we going to give the free money to today? And it makes you a little mad. It makes you mad that this, you know, may not have been put entirely right. And it makes you wonder whether or not one day something like this could happen again. If not here, then maybe somewhere else.
Kyle Whitmire is a reporter with the Birmingham News. Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you.
Uncomfortable futures like that in Birmingham, Alabama, could be in store for more and more cities, especially those in the sand states like California, Nevada, and Florida. They've been hit by the housing collapse, tax revenues fallen, and with it, spending on public infrastructure, services, and schools. That's the argument Meredith Whitney makes in her new book, Fate of the States, The New Geography of American Prosperity. And she's with us now. Hey, Meredith.
Hi.
So one of the main points in your book is that we're going to see this shift in economic power from the coast to the central part of the country. Why is that?
The center part of the country, you know, sometimes known as the flyover states, have deep roots in farming and the agriculture sector, mm-hmm. and commodities and whatnot. And so inherently, those are highly cyclical, boom-bust type industries. Because of that, their governments are run extremely conservatively, so they don't have big swings in their revenues. They don't operate with big swings in their expenses. So why that's a big deal is they didn't get themselves into any trouble. So no housing boom happened there. No housing bust happened there. Nothing really got out of whack. So they start with much drier powder, a lot more dry powder.
So what are these states? Can you just name some of these states that you think are really poised to do well going ahead?
You start with Texas in terms of population density, second largest economy, second largest population. Over to, you can go as west as far as, you know, Colorado, Utah, go over to areas even, you know, Indiana, Wisconsin, all the way up to North Dakota. A lot of this is energy, but also a lot of this is these states are right-to-work states. So companies feel like they have more control over hiring and firing in those areas. These states, again, have more often than not have very low tax burdens. So that's also attractive to businesses. And these states have much more affordable housing and just ease of standard of living. So those are the states that are not only have unemployment rates that are half that those of the coasts, but also where job creation is coming from and where people are moving for a myriad of reasons.
So one way to put a bet on a different part of the country, if you can't move there or move your business there, is to buy municipal bonds. But there have been a lot of high-profile bankruptcies recently. And I wonder if you think municipal financing is a potential trouble spot for the economy and for investor portfolios.
I hope not. I think what happens is that people are unwilling to make changes. People are unwilling to make concessions unless there's some type of crisis. So let me give you an example. When Central Falls in Rhode Island went bankrupt, it scared the rest of the state into accepting pension reform. So it took a crisis to get people into line. No one wants it to be them in terms of taking the cut. But when they see how bad it is for so many localities, the bankruptcy option, then they're like, okay, we'll come to the table, we'll compromise. Sadly, that's just how human nature works.
So you think that's where we're headed, to a crisis that we respond to?
I don't know if it's a broad and deep crisis where, you know, it all happens at once, but I think it's happening community by community. And, you know, as you have more people deciding to live in areas that suit them better and are cheaper and higher, you know, have a higher standard of living, it's only going to exacerbate things.
Meredith Whitney is author of Fate of the States and CEO of the Meredith Whitney Advisory Group. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're spending a big part of this week's show on saving and retirement. And we wanted to start with the stock market. Now, it was a pretty bumpy week, but overall, stocks have been on a bit of a tear since the beginning of the year. And you don't have to take my word for it.
Dow Industrial shot out of the gate today, held on at the close.
The stock market on a rocket ride, blasting through a ceiling and closing at an all-time high.
The Dow and the S&P both breaking records.
The jump is refilling retirement accounts that were pretty much drained during the recession. Fidelity is reporting the average balance was up 75% since 2009. But are things really that rosy? For some of you we heard from on Facebook, the answer is absolutely. Andy writes his retirement account is essentially back to pre-recession levels. He says, I watched the market without enough worry in 2008 and later realized I was too late. I wrote it out. Chris says, me too, back to where we were. Painful. But not everyone's recovered. Sean writes, I'm 31. What is this retirement account of which you speak? And Carl says, right now, it's about half of what it was because I had to cash what I had out during the downturn, and I started over when I started work again in 2010. Richard Fry from Pew Research Center says, sure, the stock market has done great, but
for the typical American household, most of their nest egg is in their homes.
Which means that a soaring Dow hasn't corrected things, at least for most of us.
It's very clear that the bottom 87% of households, their wealth actually fell from 2009 to 2011, reflecting the housing market. The upper 13 wealthiest 13% of households, they gained all the increase in wealth. Their wealth has been moving forward.
For a broader answer to the question of the total amount of wealth that's been recovered, Fry points to a new report from the Federal Reserve of St. Louis.
When you take account of inflation and the increase in the number of households, they indicate that about 45% of the wealth that was lost in the recession, 45% has been recovered.
So we're still a long way from where we used to be. And to get there, we need more than a blockbuster stock market, says Fry. We need a booming housing market. We want to know how you're faring since the recession. Join the conversation on our Facebook page or at marketplacemoney.org. We're talking saving and investing on this week's show, trying to figure out if and how we can ever retire or ever afford to retire. And this might be the topic that we get the most listener mail about on our website at marketplacemoney.org, on Facebook and on Twitter. So today we've got a bunch of calls lined up and we brought in a ringer to answer questions. Jill Schlesinger. She's a certified financial planner and CBS News business analyst. Hey, Jill.
Great to be with you.
So before we get to listener questions, I saw a Gallup poll that said about half of young people are pretty optimistic about retirement. They think they're going to have enough money to take care of themselves, to enjoy life after work. And I got to wonder, realistic or not so much?
Oh, I think realistic.
Yeah?
I think especially, yeah, because I think with the youth, at least, you've got time on your side. A lot of the kids who are, say, under 30 years old, notice I say kids at the big tell about my own age. if you're under 30, you really have learned painful lessons coming into a tough job market. You've probably seen your parents suffer, maybe your grandparents suffered during the Great Recession. And I think that these are actually, they tend to be the types of people who become very good savers. So I'm optimistic with them.
So talking about and thinking about retirement can actually be really scary, especially when we toss around numbers like we need to save 15% of our income. I wonder what advice you have just to sort of remain undaunted by those numbers. I mean, part of you wants to just stick your head in the sand and hope it goes away.
I understand that. I mean, it's not unlike the first time I ever went to Weight Watchers when I was in college and you step on the scale, the moment before you step on the scale
no.
And you're freaking out. So it is a bit like that and it can become daunting. But I'll use that Weight Watchers analogy. The cool thing is if you break it down little pieces at a time, it's not so daunting. So I think the best advice is that you just have to do what is within your capabilities of doing today. And you don't have to worry that you're not doing 15% this second. There may be other priorities in your life that you have to deal with first. Maybe you've got to pay down some nasty old credit card debt. Maybe you've got to pay down some student loans and you can't do 15%, but you want to get in the habit of putting some amount of money aside, hopefully the most you can stomach and still have a good life, and just increase that a little bit as you can. You know, when I was a financial planner, I did that for 14 years. What I found fascinating was that sometimes people who came in with the worst, most screwed up financial situations in the beginning turned it around. It was like a miracle before my eyes. And you could see that once they made a decision to make the change, once they said, yeah, I'm going to clock that debt down, I'm going to really do my best, and then they shifted the money they were using to pay down debt and they moved it into savings, they became some of the best savers of all of my clients.
So sort of like Weight Watchers, you just got to put your mind to it, huh?
Well, you have to put your mind to it, and just like Weight Watchers, you probably have to put some sort of plan in place. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to have an 80-page Harvard Business School study of your financial life, but you have to have a few goals that you're really striving to reach, and then you have to have certain action steps to help you get there. You don't have to make it so daunting. You know, it's not that complicated. It's just very emotional, and when we take some of the emotions out and you put your game plan together, it makes it a lot easier to achieve.
So let's go to some callers right now. We have Steven in New York City. Hey, Steven.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. So you just sold your apartment. Why now? Why'd you sell it now?
We have a daughter who's preparing to go into kindergarten soon, and we were running out of space, and we wanted to be in a better school district.
And what makes this new school district worth moving for?
It's the best in Brooklyn.
All righty. So what's your question for Jill?
So we walked away from the sale of our apartment with a nice little nest egg. Because we had to move quickly, we decided to rent where we are now, and I think we'll be there for about 2 years, and then we'll likely look to buy again. And when I went into the bank with the checks after the closing, I asked about CD rates, some place to park it besides just putting it in my savings account where it is now. And they immediately started trying to sell me on a managed investment portfolio. Yeah, and I always get suspicious when banks try to sell something because they're not usually in the business of giving away money. So I listened to their pitch, and they call me about once a week. It's been about a month, and I'm just sort of not really sold on that, even though the rates seem to be good, and I like the access to the money in case something happened. But the fees were at 1.6%, which I thought were very high.
How much money is it? What's the nest egg?
So after paying off all sorts of bills and having an emergency fund left over, I think there's about $100,000 that we have to do something with.
And presumably that $100,000 represents a down payment or something beyond the down payment?
That would be less than a down payment, more than likely in New York.
In New York, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and it's a 2-year time horizon, right?
Yes. And, you know, obviously, you know, it's, I do have, you know, about 3 months of expenses put away, but I'm always a little paranoid, so if something really bad happened, I would like to have access to it even within the 2 years, although I'm not planning for that.
So I'm going to give you 5 stars for having the best first idea, which is I have to keep this money safe because I
right.
cannot afford to lose it. So even though you have rotten, like silly, laughable CD rates,
yes.
that's about what you're going to be looking at because you're going to start looking for, if you want, you know, renting for 2 years, that means you're going to start looking in maybe a year and a half.
Right.
And you could find something fast.
Right.
And if you found something really fast in that, you know, the first weekend you went out looking and you needed access to the money, you would be really heartbroken if it were invested in some managed account and the market happened to be down.
Right.
And you just can't invest for a 18-month or a 24-month time horizon. It's asking for trouble. So, you know, could you have some money in a high-yield savings account? Could you go searching for credit unions for better rates? Yes. Are they still going to be rotten rates? Yeah, they definitely are. But you're trading that low interest for security of the principal, and you cannot afford to gamble this $100,000. You just can't. So unless you had some other like high interest debt that was outstanding, I would go with your initial inclination, which is keep this money safe.
At least those bankers will stop calling, huh?
Well, you miss the banker. It'll be sad for you. Maybe we should call him every week now. Just check in. How you doing?
That would be a good idea. Okay, so you're thinking like a 3-month CD that you just keep rolling over?
Yeah, I think, you know, you could do maybe a, you know, there's a couple of tricks here. There are some banks that will offer a 7-year CD. I know, stay with me here.
All right.
You're not going to keep it there for 7 years, but they have very low penalties for breaking the CD. So you can go online and you can, you know, there's a great website called depositaccounts.com.
Okay.
And they give you all the different CD rates. And what you'll find is there are some CDs that are longer term that if you break them before that term have a very sort of a minor penalty for breaking them. So you may go longer with the idea that, okay, big deal. If I had to pay the penalty, I would. And you're collecting that higher interest. But when you start comparing, it is paltry. I know it. But it is way more important that that money is secure for you.
What do you think is a good target percentage that I should look for?
Well, we always your first target is not to lose it, so we've already accomplished that. I'm very happy about that. We are
not
doing business.
Right.
That's right. You did not start the year at minus 1.6, so that's good news. You know, it's going to be like 1% or 2%.
Okay.
And just hold your nose and do it, huh?
Absolutely.
All right, Stephen, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Good luck to you. We're talking about working our way into retirement with personal finance expert Jill Schlesinger. If you have a question that Marketplace Money can help you with, you can always get in touch with us on our Facebook page or visit marketplacemoney.org and send us an email. And that's what Jane of Montana did. She's with us now, Jill. Hey, Jane.
Hi.
So you're about ready to retire, hopefully. Is that right?
Yes, I would love to.
So what's standing in your way?
A debt. We have incurred quite a lot, actually the most debt we've ever had in the past 10 years. And that's what's keeping me from retiring right now.
And how old are you?
I am 70.
70 years old. So where'd this debt come from?
Not willing to say no is part of it, a pretty big part of it. We did have to replace two vehicles for ourselves this past year.
We is you and your husband, is that right?
My husband, right. Mm-hmm. But we have, we've purchased a number of vehicles for our offspring, and the last one absolutely did not have my okay, but it was purchased anyway. And he has retired. My husband has.
So you're the one paying for this vehicle you didn't condone the purchase of.
Right. My husband recently invested some money that he inherited. And the first quarter, we lost $1,000. Several said that that's probably from fees. At the time, I wanted him to find somebody to talk to first before investing and maybe pay off bills. I'm wondering now, can we pay off or should we take that out? We could pay off about half of the debt with that. We would still be left with probably $10,000 to $12,000. That's debt. As far as savings, what you would say, emergency funds, it's somewhere around $5,000 to $6,000. I have a 401k worth between $25,000 and $30,000, and I understand I have to roll that over or withdraw it or something starting when I'm 70 and a half, which is coming up pretty soon.
So, hi, Jane. It's Jill here.
Hi.
The first thing is that I think your primary question, I just added the numbers up quickly. It sounded like you have about $50,000 in debt, right?
And yeah, 57.
57, okay. And that debt, do you happen to know the interest rate that is on that debt? Do you have about a ballpark about everything?
They go all the way from 495 interest to 9.5.
Okay. So this makes it very easy because, first of all, the money that is, I'll tell you why, the money that is right now that you said that was invested, that you lost some money on, it could have been fees, it could have been the market, who knows, doesn't matter. The most important thing that you could do is take that money out of wherever it's invested and start paying down your debt, going from the highest interest loan down to the lowest interest loan. And you can brag to your husband that he's a genius because he has figured out a way to get a 9.5% guaranteed return on his investment. That's all he's doing when you're paying down a 9.5% debt. It's like the most amazing thing in the world. You're not going to get 9.5% guaranteed. You can get 2% guaranteed right now. So that's the most important thing. With the $10,000 to $12,000 that remains, do you think that if you could start paying that down on an accelerated basis if you were still working?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I think the game plan would be to take the money out of the investments, pay down the highest interest debt first, and then work very hard to pay down the remaining debt. And then we get to the hard part, which is you cannot accumulate this kind of debt going forward. You just can't, because you're gonna work yourself into a grave.
Right.
Do you think your husband is willing to hear that?
Oh, yes. I think that he wants out of it, too.
And how does that play out in your relationship now?
Not a lot of talking. Mm. Not a lot of discussing concerning these things.
Do you think if you brought your husband and your child to the table and you sat down and talked about these things, you could get somewhere?
If I could get the son there, it's just difficult to discuss things without certain ones, you know, without him getting upset.
Do you have a trusted person in your life who could help negotiate this with your son and your husband, like a lawyer or an accountant or somebody who they both respect who could help kind of arbitrate this? Because the reason I ask is that sometimes when I was an advisor, I would often be in this position where I was helping to kind of arbitrate, mediate things, situations like this, where you have one person in the couple who just can't help stopping the kid, and the other person who wants to be a bit more of the tough love person, and it creates conflict in the couple. And frankly, it doesn't serve the kid any good way, because the kid is just can't get out of his own way in that situation. I mean, look, you guys can't afford to do this. You can't keep you know, accumulating debt for your son or for your daughters or whoever else is it's happening for. And I'm just wondering, that debt that you is that in your husband's name or in your name jointly?
It all of it except that one vehicle is in both of our names, but the one vehicle is just in my husband's name.
I mean, one thing that you could really start to do if he's not going to shift is that, you know, first of all, the easiest thing is you could say you can stop co-signing anything. You just cannot.
Yeah,
you know, like, that's easy, right?
Several years ago at co-signing things, yeah.
And you own your house outright?
We did. Until we borrowed a down payment for his house, for the son's house.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have the house anymore,
yeah.
But we still have
and you
that.
Have the debt. That's the problem. I mean, look, this is a terrible situation. If I'm being cruel, I'll give you the cruel and then the compassionate, Jill. Which one you want first, cruel or compassionate?
Let's go cruel
first. Who do you want first? You want to
go cruel? Let's go cruel, and then we'll end with compassion.
Okay, cruel that you say, I love you, honey, I'm not living like this, and I'm not going to get drowned in your inability to say no to our son, and I'm going to divorce you, and I'm going to take my 401k, and you can take your debt, and that's that. That's your big threat, right? Now I'll give you the compassionate one.
Yes, please.
Let me give you a compassionate one. Honey, I know you love our son, and I love our son. I'm really scared for our financial future. and we can't keep living like this. So we've got to figure a way out. And I think we need to go see somebody with our son, either somebody you can think of as a family friend, or go pay someone by the hour to help you with this. And spend a few bucks so you have some third party who's coming in and delivering the tough messages. Because otherwise, I don't. This is not one of these things where there's an easy out. This is going to be painful no matter which way you go.
Jane, good luck to you. Please let us know how this goes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Much appreciated.
Jill, if you don't mind sticking around just a second, we have a couple more listeners who would love your advice. And if you've got questions for us, you can go on our website, marketplacemoney.org. Today we're talking about the hard work it takes to retire comfortably. And we've got Jill Schlesinger with us. She's a certified financial planner and CBS News business analyst. Let's go to the phones. First, we have Joshua in Roseville, Minnesota. Hey, Josh.
Hi there.
So what do you do in Roseville?
I work for the Public Works Department.
So what's your question for Jill?
Well, both my wife and I are lucky enough that we have pension plans. She's a nurse. And I contribute 6.25% to my pension, and my employer contributes as well. But my wife, it's a fully employer-paid plan. And her plan, we get a letter every year saying that it's endangered. It's yellow zone. Mm. And so I guess a couple of questions about pensions, just how much can I count on them, being that I'm only 32 now? Is it still going to be around when I'm retiring? And should I still be putting away extra money besides what I'm contributing to my pension?
That's a great question. You know, I think when you're talking about as a public works employee, I think obviously your plan is safer than your wife's, right? We know that already.
Why now, is that, Jill?
Well, usually because the public plan has this wonderful thing called taxation, which it can use to help fill the coffers a little bit. When you have the some of the employer plans, now I'm not saying they don't carry insurance, and it may be that they've got unfunded pension liabilities, and that's why it's in the yellow zone, not quite in the red zone yet. But that said, they're telling you that there's a problem with the plan, right? It doesn't mean that your wife's going to lose the money that's in that plan. Either. I mean, do they give you a cash balance, her share, or what would be converted into a cash balance of that plan on an annual basis?
Yeah, their formula is it's pretty confusing for me, but it's, you know, there's a certain number of hours to dollars that they give us on her pay stub every year.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I think that it's unlikely that she would go to zero. But if you're asking me, do I think that you should be putting extra money away? Yes, I absolutely do. Because I think that as a younger employee, my guess is that your pension isn't as rich as some of your older coworkers who came into the system under different circumstances. And that's the problem with a lot of these pension jobs is that, you know, the benefits for the people who are 50, 60 years old are not going to change, but it's the younger ones coming in who don't have quite as rich a plan. So I think that if you can, right, in that meaning that if you can afford to put money away in addition to these pension plans, that would be great. Can your cash flow allow that?
It can. We just bought a house last year, so there's lots of demands there, too. But that's why I was calling, to try and decide if I should be trying to make it more of a priority.
I would think so. I mean, given your age, you know, I think it probably would make sense for you guys to maybe try to put some money into a Roth IRA as a nice supplemental retirement. Do you have kids?
Yes, two very small. Well, 1 and 3-year-old.
That's
a handful there.
Yeah.
Are you tempted to start saving for college?
Yes. We're kind of relying on the grandparents for right now.
I love that.
We should start thinking about that soon.
I'm going to take you off the hook on that a little bit, though, Josh. And I would much prefer that you fund a Roth IRA than to put money into college savings. I think it's more important that you secure your retirement first before starting to save money for the kids.
Which can feel, sure. You know, jumping in here, it can feel counterintuitive, right? You got this 1 and 3 year old there. They look at you with their sweet little eyes.
Oh, those cherubs, I know. You know, here's the problem. And I always use this analogy. And, you're in the airplane and the flight attendant says, put the oxygen mask on yourself first and then on the kid. And it so goes for your financial life. You've got to secure your financial life first before you start saving for your kid's college education. There's a lot of choices for college, right? You can say, hey, kids, you're going to do work. You're going to go to a community college. You're going to go to state school. You're going to work hard. You're going to do, there's not a lot of choices for retirement. There's no handy dandy federal loan program to help you through your retirement. So it's really imperative that you feel secure about your own future before you start pushing money into a 529 plan or some sort of, savings account for your kid. And so I'm going to take you off the hook on that one. I would much, much prefer you put money into a Roth before you started doing college.
Josh, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks.
Good luck to you. And Jill, we've got another young person on the phone with us, Ginger from North Carolina, who also has a question about extra savings in her retirement account. Hey, Ginger.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us, what's your question for Jill?
So yeah, I'm young. I'm in my late 20s, and I'm very fortunate to have a good job and to be able to save every year. So I've contributed the maximum allowable amount to my IRA for the past few years. And yeah, my question is really about that maximum amount. You know, am I allowed now to say like, oh, okay, I'm done. You know, I contributed as much as I can.
Done.
Or should I really try to save more if I can? And I think I can. So what might be a good way to save, once I've kind of maxed out my designated retirement accounts, what should I think about doing next?
First off, very impressive, Ginger. I have
yes.
to say,
oh.
28 maxing out your Roth IRA contribution is
very good.
Thank you.
Tell us about some of your other goals. Like, you're young and you've got some money that you're putting away for retirement. Did you ever think, are you trying to accumulate money to maybe buy a house or do something different in the near to intermediate term?
Yeah, I kind of have trouble thinking about those kinds of commitments. My mom keeps telling me that I should be saving for a house, but that doesn't really sound fun to me. I don't really want to own a house.
But I have a question. Is saving for retirement fun for you?
I feel this need to save in general. I just feel like it's something that I should do. And retirement is the farthest off, most kind of unimaginable at this point. Goal. And so it's something that I don't really have to commit to. It's just this thing that I can look forward to. But a house is kind of like, I would rather be able to travel. I'd rather be able to move around. I'd rather be free.
Okay, let's not call it a house fund. Let's just call it a different thing. Let's just call it something else, because I think I'll make you feel better about this. Because you've actually made a pretty major league commitment. You are committing to invest for 30 years. That's what happens with mm-hmm. retirement, right? You can't pull the money out till you're 59 and a half. So you've just made a 30-year commitment. Of course, it is with yourself, so it's not so bad. But I think that it would work if you created some kind of account. Let's call it a general investment account. I'm not going to call it a house account or anything like that. Just a separate account that is does not enjoy any tax preference. It's just a plain old taxable account where you can start putting money away, where it could be your travel fund, or it could be your new car fund.
Or house fund.
Shh, quiet, don't say that. See what we're doing? We're playing a game here. And you can use that money for whatever comes up in the near term. Mm-hmm. Now, the only thing is that in that kind of general investment account, you would probably want to invest in a more conservative fashion, because if you decide that a year from now you want to go to Africa and you want to pull a lot of money out, you don't want there to be a ton of risk in the account. So you want to stick to a more conservative type of investment than you would be doing in your retirement account, because, think of this as a 2 to 5 year fund versus a 30 year fund.
Sure. That makes sense.
Ginger, thanks so much for contacting us.
All right. Thank you.
And Jill Schlesinger, thank you so much for being with us.
It was such a great pleasure. And I'm glad that we could give people both the real stuff, but we could also make it a little bit of fun. Remember, most of this is very emotional. Everyone gets that. But you have to really be clear that once you push those emotions away, there are some concrete choices that you can make to really improve your financial life.
Good advice, Jill. Jill Schlesinger is CBS News business analyst and a certified financial planner. As we chatted about with Jill earlier in the hour, sometimes retirement is just impossible to afford. And other times, stopping work cold turkey is just jarring. I mean, what do you do with all that time? Nancy Collamer is here with us with some suggestions. She's the author of Second Act Careers, 50-plus ways to profit from your passions during semi-retirement. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
So what are these second act careers and who's looking for them?
Well, we've got over 78 million baby boomers who are approaching retirement age, and their retirement's not going to be their parents' retirement. As we well know, lots of people have not saved enough for retirement, but even among those who have, people are living longer, healthier lives, and they are looking for meaningful ways to spend those hours.
And so what are some examples of semi-retirement jobs?
Well, in the book, I cover a wide range of possibilities, everything from creating informational products on the web to I even have a chapter about getting paid to travel, which I joke is everyone's favorite chapter.
Now, is that real? Can you actually get paid to travel?
Well, it's difficult to earn enough to make a living. But the reality is that one of the things you do want to think about in terms of semi-retirement careers is sometimes it's about offsetting the costs of doing things that you want to do during retirement. So using travel as an example, lots of people hope to be able to travel during retirement, mm-hmm. but that can get to be mighty expensive. So if you can find a way to offset those costs, you won't need to go into savings to fund your travel dreams.
So, and that brings me to a question. A lot of the suggestions in the book seem to be about things that are more on the fun side than necessarily the money-making side of jobs. And is that what we should expect from these second acts?
I don't think that's necessarily correct. The book covers a wide range of options, and I was very careful to select possibilities that people can mix and match and combine into different levels of income streams depending upon their individual goals and objectives. So, for example, you know, one person may want to work as an adjunct professor at a university, and that's enough for them. But somebody else who's looking to earn more money may want to do that and combine it with perhaps a part-time job or doing some consulting or coaching. So it's more about mixing together multiple streams of income. And then you can do it in a way that really meets your lifestyle objectives.
And so where do you start? If you're somebody who's thinking about retirement or thinking about work after retirement, where do you start figuring out what the right second career might be?
Well, you know, for a lot of us, this is the first time that you really get to do something because you want to do it, not just because you have to do it in order to pay the mortgage. So start by thinking about what is it that you want your life to look like? Do you want time for travel to be able to visit the grandchildren? And then you start to do an assessment of your skills and experiences. And I always advise people to start by looking at your work experience, because that's where you're going to be able to command the highest dollar. That's where your marketable skills are. But you certainly don't want to just look at those work experiences. You know, it's interesting. People in the book found their second act by tapping into hobbies and passions. One of the women I profile is someone who is an American Indian, and she grew up loving being involved with ceremonies and rituals, and she now makes her living as a celebrant, who works as essentially an interfaith minister who helps people from different faiths and backgrounds celebrate weddings and other lifestyle events.
Very interesting. Now, one thing that I was thinking about is it's got to be hard if you come from maybe a high power, big money career. Let's say you're a CEO and you retire and you maybe take a volunteer position or a less powerful second act career. How do people deal with that transition?
You're absolutely right. It's a bit of an ego adjustment for a lot of people. It's hard to go from the corner office to being the person who has to empty their own trash. So the way that you do this is in baby steps. I typically advise people that even starting 3 years ahead is really not too soon, because you need time to figure out what it is that you want to do, time to research alternatives, and then time to either go look for that part-time job or create your own business. And, you know, life has a tendency of getting in the way. So start it soon.
Nancy, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Nancy Collamer is the author of Second Act Careers, 50-plus ways to profit from your passions during semi-retirement. And we've got some of those tips to finding your perfect next job at our website, marketplacemoney.org. There's always some risk to charting new professional territory. Putting yourself out there in a job you've never done before can be intimidating. Well, a new film called The Internship explores the idea of starting over in the workforce. It stars Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson as a pair of middle-aged guys vying for a coveted spot in Google's internship program.
Your interns?
Yeah.
Shut up.
Deal with it.
You're so old, though. I thought you were important.
Sometimes the long shots pay off the biggest.
Sounds like we've got an Oscar contender there. Marketplace's tech reporter Queena Kim saw the film. Hey, Queena.
Hey.
So we just heard a cut from the movie, Queena, and it sounds like age is definitely a factor. I mean, these guys are older in the movie than most of the other interns around them. But I was wondering, how does it play out? How does age play out in the movie?
Well, in some pretty predictable ways. Most of the way it plays out is that they're just not very hip on technology. They don't really know what any of these guys are talking about. And they're just very much fish out of water.
Are they treated better or worse because they're older?
Not better. Definitely worse. You know, the way that the movie is structured is it's supposed to be this competition. So they're sort of, and all the interns get to pick teams. So they're sort of like the kids at the, you know, on the school playground who are left for last. Nobody wants to be on their team. Nobody wants to have them on their team because the perception is that they don't know anything.
Now, I'm sure our listeners out there are going to be sensitive to this point. I know they think sometimes, you know, pop culture can malign older folks and their lack of use of technology.
Well, I would say I can understand why they get offended by the stereotype, but working in tech and being a little older, I won't tell you how old I am, I definitely feel that age difference myself, that half the times I don't even really know what anybody's talking about. So, yeah, they might not be happy to hear it, but I've sort of found being out in the workplace myself that it does ring true.
So, you know, I was wondering realistically, is there any way a 40-year-old guy without a tech background could get an internship at Google these days?
I would say that the chances are almost zero. You have to be enrolled in a university. And then according to their website, you actually have to be going back after you do your internship. So I imagine that most 40-year-olds wouldn't fit into that category.
Queena Kim is Marketplace's tech reporter. Thanks, Queena.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Tell us what you thought about our show today. We're online at marketplacemoney.org. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, we're going to look at the state of the consumer economy and how much it costs to help your kids keep up with the kids next door.
We're paying this now, you know, baseball bats, football equipment, fees, gas, is so that they can have an opportunity to be noticed and recognized by these schools out here to get them what they want and where they want to be in life.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Lindsay Foster Thomas, Daryl Perinata, and Devin Maverick Robbins. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore, and I'm Adrian Hill. Thanks for listening. This is APM.